I'm Carrie Thompson with a playback trip through the NPR archives of exactly 25 years ago, a time for deep thoughts.
People across the country once again will quietly contemplate how sauerkraut fits into our lives hot dog-wise, and vice versa.
As it turns out, Feb 86 was just the right time and place to contemplate the glories of sauerkraut with Bob Garfield. And fortified with serrings of kraut, people took on larger issues.
I don't think it takes a great mental genius to see the role that women are playing today.
That's a guy who's trying to sell cars to a new generation of women. You know, a humanoid species defined as
a person who may have the money and the ability and the desire to buy one of your products.
Nina Totenberg will have the interview. Then we'll have a story about actors and day jobs, and I will warn you, parental discretion is advised.
I mean, you think, well, I'm doing it for the money, but there's this sort of sense of, what if I did this all the time? What if I did this all the time? What if I did this all the time? What if I did this all the time?
What if we did this all the time? It would be very disorienting. Our first story out of the vault is Mr. Tom Baudet, the guy from Alaska. He had just discovered something disturbing about his peer group.
I'm a part of what I'll call the lost generation. Dyed-in-the-wool baby boomers for sure, but that part of it that was caught between the excitement of the Vietnam era and the success-minded drudgery of the me decade. We were too young to really be a part of the 60s and were more apt to have our noses pressed up to the window of social consciousness than to get our folks' permission to go inside. Well, I thought shoplifting Abby Hoffman's Steal This Book was a cultural statement and owned a copy of Jerry Rubin's Revolution for the Hell of It because it had the F word on the cover. Adolescent hippies seemed ridiculous even to themselves. Well, I finally broke away from my hometown and headed out west to see if the summer of love was still going on. Well, then Nixon resigned. Game over. Haight-Ashbury was nothing but drug clinics and boutiques, and everybody moved to Oregon to open health food stores. And there I was, dressed to the nines of an era that just died. Well, that was the last time I cared about a social trend. My clothes don't make a statement, and I can't program a computer. When the lost generation got to college, the arts and letters were still a respected course of study. It was those students just after us that decided statements like, I think, therefore I am, were dull and useless and changed their majors to business administration. Well, there we sat between two huge social movements with nothing to do. Just when we needed it the most, American popular culture was closed for repairs. Well, so like a lot of us, I came to Alaska where being out of style doesn't stand out very much. If you want to pretend it's 1970, you can do that. Nobody will say anything. Form little groups to ban things, have different plights to follow, and vote on and write letters to editors. Well, I know it sounds tedious, but there's company in numbers. The very heart of the baby boom cut loose from the rest and migrating north like political lemmings. We work our jobs, raise our children, and manage somehow to stay away from traditional American values just like we remember what they are. So you can see, as a part of this lost generation, I'm really not the one to be offering insights on the tendencies of modern society. I'm still stuck somewhere between Woodstock and Barry Manilow's holiday television spectacular. Well, if that makes sense to you, maybe you ought to have this job.
Maybe, but I might have to time travel. Okay, so our next essay is from commentator Andre Codrescu, and a little background is needed on this one. In early February 86, after months of protest and unrest, baby Doc Duvalier, the president of Haiti, was forced out of office. Coincidentally, in the same month, Ferdinand Marcos, president of the Philippines, also lost his job.
Exiled Philippine leader Ferdinand Marcos made his first public statement tonight since leaving the Philippines on Monday. Steve Futterman reports from Honolulu.
The deposed Philippine leader spoke for just 4 minutes. He refused to answer any questions. Instead, he read a seven-paragraph statement, which he called a letter to the Philippine people. Marcos accused rebel forces led by two of his former aides, General Ramos and General Enrile, of trying to take over the government. Marcos claimed to have still had enough military power to have withstood the revolt. However, he said the use of such force would have resulted in bloody carnage of innocent civilians. And Marcos said, I have no heart to shed Filipino blood. Marcos implored his fellow countrymen to never forget the ideals and noble objectives which he said we will attain only through the peaceful unification of our people. Marcos concluded his statement by saying, "I remain your humble servant." Marcos appeared to be relaxed. He sat next to his wife, Imelda, on a special platform set up just outside the officers' club. He said he is presently looking for private quarters to live. He did not say where. Until he finds those new accommodations, however, the Marcos family will remain here at Hickam Air Force Base. For National Public Radio, this is Steve Futterman in Honolulu.
So what to do with Marcos and Baby Doc? Commentator Andrei Codrescu had some ideas.
Nobody wants a used dictator. Look at poor Baby Doc. Shunned like a bag of bad gris-gris. He owns houses in France, but France won't let him live in them. He wants to emigrate to the United States, but our dictator quota for the year has been filled. Of course, it's all a game to fool those who'd have his hide. The truth is that Baby Duck knows well where he's headed for. It's a little mountainous region in the no-man's land between the borders of two powerful nations. It's a pretty place, filled with innocent-looking bungalows. It has no official name, though some call it Tirania, not to be confused with Tirana, the capital of Albania, though it resembles Albania in many respects. In Tirania, a great many experiments are being conducted by countries too ashamed to be openly associated with used dictators. One of these experiments concerns the removal of certain substances from the brains of used dictators to see if a serum could be manufactured to inoculate people against an excessive appetite for power. That's noble. Another experiment has the ex-dictators developing the artistic talents that they all, without exception, had before the world rejected them and they had to become dictators. This is based on the well-known fact that if only the art world would have appreciated Hitler's paintings, he would have become Hitler the painter instead of Hitler the horror. Baby Duck's bungalow has been ready for his arrival since the day that he took power. One of the features of Tirania is that it expects all dictators eventually, no matter how powerful they seem. The other feature is that Tirania is non-ideological. Castro has a bungalow here waiting for him, right next to Franco's. That's the other feature. There is no recognition of death in Tirania. Stalin, Attila the Hun, Idi Amin, and Pol Pot all live in harmonious cement bunkers filled with electronics. They play canasta and watch videotapes of mass murders and tortures. Some prefer one, some the other. Excitement is high in Tirania today. Both Baby Duck and Ferdinand Marcos are expected to arrive at about the same time.
Commentator Andrei Codrescu. And now for a perky little story about women. Women in 1986, that is. You see, car makers were catching on that women were a desirable demographic because they were working and earning cash and buying cars. Here's Nina Totenberg talking with Chrysler car executive Bud Liebling.
Women are just getting so darn important in the whole society, and that flows over into the car buying decision. We've found that about 80% of all cars that are purchased have a woman very, very actively involved in the purchase decision.
Did your dealers tell you, God, we're losing sales because women are turned off? What made you realize?
I think every day you live is active research, and you just see what's happening all around you. The day of the woman strictly being in the home is not there, and that was one role for a woman to play. Now she's playing that role, and she's being the mother and the homemaker, but there's a lot of other women who are not in that role. They're working women, they're single, they're cohabiting or whatever they're doing, but they're not into the family thing. They've got careers, and women have choice. Their lives are every bit as broad or more broad as men's. I don't think it takes a great mental genius to see the role that women are playing today.
What is Chrysler doing now that it is different from what Chrysler, that is different from what other automobile manufacturers are doing?
It used to be that the lighted visor vanity mirror was only on the passenger side because the woman was supposed to be the passenger. She wasn't supposed to be driving the car, theoretically.
Mm-hmm.
And we heard from a lot of women saying, hey, wait a minute, this is my car, I drive it. I drive it to work, or I drive it to social engagements, or I drive it to whatever. What do you want me to do, jump over the center armrest to see how I look? Well, fine, put it in. So it's now on both sides. It's on the passenger side and the driver's side.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most important single thing, though, would be the design, the interior design of the car. Let's take seat belts, shoulder harnesses, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They were designed, we had the dummies that we put in the cars, And they were basically, the seat belts were designed to conform to be comfortable to men. Well, men and women are shaped different biologically, and thank God they are. So we're trying to make the seat belts a little bit more flexible.
Okay, now I'm looking at a brochure that is aimed at your dealers. And the cover of it says, "Today's Woman Buyer, Smart and Serious." Presume for a minute that I'm the dealer. What is it you're trying to tell me?
I'm trying to tell you, to get the word out to your sales force that when a woman comes in to a showroom, don't judge anything about the fact that she's a woman. Don't worry about what she's wearing, whether she's in jeans and a sweatshirt or a very custom-tailored suit. You go over there and you introduce yourself and you treat her like a person who may have the money and the ability and the desire to buy one of your products.
I've read some material that suggests that women are interested in getting a car that will last a long time, that will be a long-term investment. And I guess that I'm the primary example of that. I keep my cars for 15 years. I've owned two cars
don't
in my adult
you.
Life.
We need more people who trade them faster.
Well, is there any concern that when you treat me with respect and et cetera, and you spend a lot of time with me, I won't be back for 15 years?
No. We want to sell you a car today. I mean, we would like it if you came back more often, but we want to sell you a car today.
Click, clank, open up a door, girls. Click, clank, open up a door, boys. Front door, back door, clink a dick, clack, take you riding in my car.
And now, an award for the most original opening line for a story. Here he is, Bob Garfield.
Prepare the wieners, mon petit chou. Get that can opener rolling and let the zestiness commence. For the 38th straight year, National Kraut and Frankfurter Week is upon us. I went to St. Charles, Illinois, the sauerkraut capital of the world, and I return with good news. From Thursday through February 22nd, people across the country once again will quietly contemplate how sauerkraut fits into our lives hot dog-wise, and vice versa. Imagine the billion-fold sacrifice of Leuconostoc messerentoides microorganisms who swim valiantly in caustic brine to attack that mighty shredded cabbage, martyring themselves in the fermentation process so that the average American might have his 1.5 pounds of kraut a year. That's right, a mere 1.5 pounds. Time was every man, woman, and child enjoyed a 2-pound annual kraut consumption. But things have changed, which is why Kraut and Frank Week is so crucial. The National Kraut Packers Association promotes the daylights out of the Reuben sandwich, but one savory combo can go only so far. The nation's kraut economy depends on places like Honiota's Supermarket in Joliet, Illinois, where this week they'll build double kraut displays and reap 5 to 10 times more sales. Like Paul Hooper says, he's manager of the Wiseway Supermarket in Gary, Indiana, housewives have to be reminded to buy kraut. I'm just sorry all the reminding must be done in an environment of controversy and distrust. Take the American Bakers Association. The bakers are outraged that the kraut packers' literature depicts Franks with heaps of kraut on platters and skillets, never in a bun. Bakers Association President Robert Wager calls it grossly unfair and says it breaks up the, quote, sacred bond between hot dogs, sauerkraut, and buns. At the Association for Dressings and Sauces, condiment expert Barbara Preston goes so far as to dismiss kraut as a mere accessory to the hot dog. She says the real synergism comes from your mustard, your ketchup, your relish. And the National Pork Council takes the position that kraut and frank talk is irrelevant. The pig lobby says pork and sauerkraut are the natural combination. These people miss the point. Kraut and franks isn't something you quibble about. It's like long waits at the doctor's office or missile development. You have it, you live with it, and by Gemini, you learn to love it.
NPR's Bob Garfield. By the way, I used to have a really weird college roommate who would gurk, that's a Wisconsin drinking term, she would gurk sauerkraut juice, actual 6 packs of sauerkraut juice. And I'll tell you, it did not do good things for her disposition. Speaking of learning to love it, we bring you a story about actors and their day jobs. A story so scary and real that against my better judgment, I am compelled to share it with you.
Here in Los Angeles, it seems that almost everyone working in a restaurant or boutique or bookstore or beauty salon is really an actor, just trying to get by while waiting for that really big break. On any given day, 85% of the 30,000 actors in Hollywood aren't anywhere near a camera. Last year, 80% made less than $5,000. That means a lot of actors are doing a lot of other things to pay the bills.
Busboy, waiter, bartender.
Magician's assistant, child schlepper.
I was the eyes for a blind lawyer.
Junk mail stuffer.
I handed out flyers for a seminar giver.
Schlepping stuff all over the city. It's bizarre.
I'm selling insurance.
I bucked hay. I was a farmer. I stacked it. It's called bucking hay.
I even sold candy. At high schools, sold candy so high school kids could raise money for Pep Squad uniforms.
That's me, temporary. How may I help you?
Actors use temporary job agencies to help them make the rent. A performer's day might start with 3 hours of dead fish plucking at a pet store, then an audition for a movie, followed by a little proofreading in a lawyer's office, a quick dinner, and an evening of bartending at an art opening. The idea here is to keep your options open so that when real work comes along, you'll be available.
I've acted since I was 4 years old. You know, I've done films and lots of stage and things, Shakespeare and things, and I've been recognized more as a dancing cupcake than from anything else that I've done. That upsets, you know, when the butcher says, "I just saw you, you're the cupcake." It's like it puts it all in perspective.
Almost every actor has stuffed envelopes and worked at what's politely called telemarketing. Whether it's soap, security, socks, or sex, the someone selling it on the phone is probably an out-of-work actor.
I've been doing fantasy phone calls for 3 years. Oh, yeah. Oh. Oh, yeah. Mm. If I were working like 6 hours, I could be... easily answering 30 or 40 or 50,
yeah, really.
Getting that many phone calls.
Boy, real soon.
I'm making $45 an hour here.
Okay. Bye-bye. Talk to you later.
Actors aren't really any different than the rest of us. They've just chosen a career where many are called and few are chosen. It's kind of like being one of 5,000 car mechanics in a town that has only 20 automobiles. After years of waiting for the phone to ring, some actors begin to accept the notion that learning something like word processing might not be such a bad idea. After all, it beats selling meat on the phone.
When you have a job for a long period of time, you cease to be objective about it. But when you're doing jobs over very short periods of time, like this, you remain very objective, and you think, what am I doing here all the time? I mean, you think, well, I'm doing it for the money, but there's this sort of sense of, what if I did this all the time? What if I did this all the time? What if I did this all the time? What if I did this all the time?
I went into a restaurant. The waitress wore a pink uniform. I ordered a Caesar salad. She got inspired.
Vinny, Vidi, Vici!
My waitress said she was performing in a modern version of the Gallic Wars, and that ever since she spoke the line,
"Caesar's wife must be above suspicion,"
her feelings about the salad had changed. I'd just come in for the garlic, for the sensation and aroma. Here I was enmeshed in a lunchroom drama.
Your bread. Better half a loaf than none at all.
Oh, God. Maybe she thinks I'm a producer, and she's giving me her best stuff.
How's everything?
Oh, fine. Really, it's fine.
A man is better pleased when he has a good dinner upon his table than when his wife speaks Greek.
As I bit into my exotic mushroom pasta, I realized she was just practicing her art. She'd found a way to mix her job, waiting tables, with her work, acting. And she was pretty good at both. A couple years later, I turned on my TV, and there she was, my proverb-spouting waitress, wearing the same pink uniform, serving up jokes in a sitcom diner.
Better an egg today than a hen tomorrow.
I guess there's more to life than beer and Skittles. I'm Eileen Segalov.
And now, for some real culture, here's Susan Stamberg.
I feel silly calling you Mr. Gillespie, but I feel I don't know you well enough to call you Dizzy.
You call me Sir.
No, I thought so.
If you like.
I thought Sir, or you know what I really thought? Your Highness. Mr. Legend might do, or Mr. Trumpet, or Mr. Virtuoso. John Birks Gillespie, musical for most of his 68 years. Dizzy, since he was 17, and showed up for a job with his trumpet in a paper bag. Known for his sense of humor, his ability to infuse an audience with his joyous spirit, and the sounds that come out of his horn. With the late Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie invented bop, a patriarch of the trumpet now, after 50 years of performing. He once started his own Dizzy for President movement, and then threatened to slug anyone who called him a dark horse.
Did you ever play the White House?
Yes, I played for Nancy in that show with the Stan Getz and Chick Corea. Is that Perelman?
Uh-huh. Is there any difference to you in the way you play from if you're playing at the White House or for the president's wife?
You need to be careful and try to play your best numbers, whatever they are. I didn't make anything special for them. As a matter of fact, I didn't even make nothing special for President Carter when he sang Salt Peanuts. That was cute, though. Man. That was really something. It was just something that would happen to an ordinary man in the street or something like that, instead of happening to the President of the United States sitting in on a jam session.
Salt peanuts. Dizzy Gillespie performed in Washington recently, minus Jimmy Carter, but surrounded by sidemen many years younger than he, all of them hanging on every note that came out of his famous up-tilted trumpet. There's a story that the trumpet first got bent by accident years ago at a birthday party. Gillespie played it, had it straightened out the next day, and then thought about how good it had sounded bent, so he had one made up especially that way.
Well, my horn, I can hear better than the average trumpet player that's got a straight horn.
You hear
that you're playing it, you know? And that's good that you can hear something as you're playing instead of an interval after.
Is that why you tilt it up? Is that the reason that you tilt the bell up like that?
The bell, it just happened to be that way when it got tilted up, and I said, ah, that's where it's supposed to be, and then I left it there.
So you can hear it better. You have an album now with these two kids. What's his name? Branford Marcellus and Kenny.
Lonnie Plaxico.
Uh-huh. Kenny Kirkland. Mm-hmm. Also young guys, young musicians, a whole new generation of young musicians coming into jazz. You like working with them, huh?
Yeah. They inspire you. New musician. Nice.
You learn things from them?
Yes, of course. Music is so deep and so vast that one person only gets the skimming off the top of whatever, and there's a whole lot under the bottom that's still there for discovery. And then you learn some of that from the young musicians. Some more.
Are they good?
Oh, yeah.
Are they as good as you were when you started?
They're better now.
Really?
Yeah.
But that business about how that piano guy was sitting watching you and trying to figure out, as I was in the audience, what's the next note going to be, and having no...
Well, see, the piano player had a great role in a small group. You see, not only has he got to compose behind you and anticipate where you're going, but he's got to be careful not to play too much or to play too little. He can play too much and get in the way, and it annoys the soloist. So he have to be, he can't be thinking about, yesterday I was at the beach and I played racquetball up against the board and I ran after three girls that were topless and I tried to catch them and I couldn't do it. And then I went to the blah, 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 to the sauna. You can't think about nothing. And that shows respect for the artist for whom you're playing.
It's not just respect. It's how you make the music good. That's what I noticed about you. Your concert, you're thinking.
First thing is respect, though.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then the music comes, you know, respect. Mm-hmm. But it's supposed to be jazz is supposed to be the most unselfish of art forms. And jazz, you give yourself completely to make somebody else play their best. You try to do something to make them, to inspire them to do something. So it is a matter of sacrifice.
Dizzy Gillespie, yes, sir, right here on Playback. And speaking of sacrifice, hats off to M. Katziff, who takes on his Playback assignment month after month. Go Mikey. Thanks again for being you and for listening. And I'm not sure what's in the vault for next month, but probably something fantastic. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.